The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 14, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border, and the thumbprint exists on the top right corner, which says our 100th year. Time, in large block lettering, is pale gray, superimposed upon black, and on it is a portrait of a man. His hair is either bald or shaved. He has blue eyes. He has some facial hair on his chin, which is salt and pepper, gray and white. He's wearing what looks like a hoodie, a gray or off-white hoodie. His eyes are blue and look askance from the camera. Out of the darkness, the untold story of Senator John Fetterman's battle with depression by Molly Ball. The portrait on the cover is credited to Shuron Huang for Time. It is Pennsylvania Democrat John Fetterman, outside a U.S. Senate office building, May 16. Beginning with the brief, Israel's War with Itself by Carl Vick. That's V-I-C-K, the roots of the country's fight over democracy and where it could go next. This is a full-page colored photograph of a building, a multi-story building in the background. It is being built. It looks like pale gray, possibly concrete blocks with several long, narrow, vertical windows. There is a large crane and some scaffolding attached to the side, which indicates it's in the process of construction. There's a mob out front. It is elbow to elbow people. Some are carrying or wearing the Israeli flag, white with the blue Star of David upon it. It looks like men and women. From the camera's lens, it appears that most are young, wearing t-shirts and baseball caps, and they look like they're in a fighting mood, but the camera view is from the back. And this again is by Carl Vick. For decades, the threats that defined Israel arrived from without and produced a basic cohesion. On security, Jewish Israelis spoke as one, historically giving the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, approval ratings near 90%. But the paroxysm convulsing the country in its 75th year is wholly internal. The current crisis arises not from any Arab neighbor, several of which now enjoy cordial relations with the Jewish state, but over how Jewish Israelis choose to live. The question is fraught and appears to threaten the fabric of the nation. Like its borders, Israel's government structure is not fixed. It is a parliamentary democracy without a constitution. The prime minister sits in the Knesset, the legislature, and the only check on the majority is the Supreme Court, which at times decides its role for itself. Now, however, the Knesset has moved to take control of the court. A law narrowly passed July 24 that bars justices from overruling government actions. The power play pushed by the most right-wing government in the country's history had already sparked 30 weeks of massive street protests at the time of the vote, with no end in sight. to win in last November's elections, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had to assemble a coalition that included parties so far right that they existed on the fringe. His national security minister was deemed unfit to serve in the IDF because of his extremism. Their grudge against the High Court dates to 2005, when the justices approved the government's removal of 8,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip. Now their eagerness to expand Jewish control in the West Bank and their antipathy toward Arabs, including the 20% of Israeli citizens who are Palestinian, has found traction in the 73% of young Israeli Jews who identify as being on the right. With young people, the least liberal demographic, Time is on the conservatives' side. Israel has long been led by European or Ashkenazi Jews, even though most Israelis today are Mizrahi, who trace their origins to the Middle East and other parts of North Africa. They are more likely to be working class and religious, and are historically underrepresented in positions of power. Netanyahu, though Ashkenazi, has long channeled Mizrahi resentments. They see the real goal of the protesters, a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. argued in a recent op-ed, as to preserve the power lost at the polls by the Ashkenazi elite. Critics have claimed Netanyahu's intentions for Israeli democracy can be detected in his embrace of Hungary's Viktor Orban and other elected Europeans with authoritarian leanings. Closer to home, Arab kingdoms that once promoted the Palestinian cause have found common ground with their erstwhile opponent. The Saudis admire Israel's tech industry, its security products like NSO's Pegasus surveillance tool have found users among authoritarian regimes and share with the country an enmity for Iran. For Israel, these newer alignments serve as a counterweight to the West and its demands. The U.S. guarantee of Israeli security has many sources, but the core of that relationship is certainly on democratic values, the White House press secretary declared after the July 24 vote, which President Biden had repeatedly warned against. His invitation for Netanyahu to visit the U.S. remains in place, however, as does support for Israel on Capitol Hill and $3.8 billion a year in military aid. The crisis is expected to continue for months, not least because the High Court is set to review the new law in September. And when the Knesset returns from recess a month later, it may take up another judicial reform, giving lawmakers a hand in naming jurists. Meanwhile, dissenters continue the search for leverage. Thousands of IDF reservists, for example, have vowed to stand down in protest. Netanyahu seems sanguine about any security threat their loss might pose, perhaps understanding that at this point, a threat from outside the nation may be the one thing guaranteed to bring it together. A column next to this article reads, "What It May Mean for Palestinians." This is by Yasmin Serhan. Much of the uproar over Israel's judicial overhaul has focused on its implications for the country's democracy. Less attention has been paid to what the Israeli government intends to do with its consolidated power. One motive, experts say, is to further the ultranationalist right's ambitions of unfettered settlement expansion and potentially of annexing the West Bank. Israeli leaders make no secret of this. Extending Israeli sovereignty to the West Bank is in their coalition agreement. In their mind, the Israeli Supreme Court has been one of the biggest hurdles in the path toward realizing that dream, says Michael Schaefer Omerman, of the D.C.-based nonprofit Democracy for the Arab World Now. The implications for Palestinians are considerable. The High Court, which they use to defend their rights in land disputes, represents one of the few institutions reigning in the settler right at a time when Palestinians are increasingly subject to deadly raids. The reality on the ground for Palestinians was bad before the judicial overhaul, says the International Crisis Group's Merav Sonstein, and it is bad now. Spain's political pains. This is actually a photograph, almost half a page. It's of a high-rise building, modern-looking, with lots of glass windows, otherwise made of either stone or concrete. There's a tree next to it, a green tree, and the building towers over that. There are two men on the side of the building where the camera is shooting. They're on scaffolding as if they were washing windows, but they're not. They're hanging a banner. Oh, no, they're unhanging it. They're stripping an electoral banner of Conservative People's Party leader Alberto Núñez Feijóo from the group's Madrid headquarters, July 24. A day earlier, that faction and its main rival, Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez's Socialist Party, both failed to secure a governing majority in elections, leaving the country's political future uncertain. Now, this banner of the People's Party leader, Alberto Núñez Feijóo, has his face on it. It's kind of grinning. One does not see the entire thing, but this is going to be an entire building tall of photographic portrait of this guy. We see his face head on. I don't know what his head, the top of his head looks like. We see just his glasses and from there on down to his collar, because this banner is being stripped. It's being furled from its place high on this building, and it's peaked at this point. The workers have already undone the top and the sides, but the top is still being hung in a point, so it looks like this guy on his big banner has a triangular-shaped head or hat. Anyway, he's going to be gone by the time I read this. The bulletin, why a tuberculosis drug will reach millions more patients. And this is by Anna Gordon. The patient on the tuberculosis drug betaquiline expired July 18. Excuse me, that is not the patient, it is the patent. The patent on the tuberculosis drug betaquiline, I'm going to spell that, B-E-D-A-Q-U-I-L-I-N-E, expired July 18. But while its manufacturer, Johnson & Johnson, could use secondary patents to extend its exclusive right to sell the drug, it instead struck an innovative deal that will lower the drug's price and expand access to it for millions of poorer people around the globe. A major public health win against the world's deadliest infectious disease. By the numbers, tuberculosis infects approximately 10 million people per year, killing some 1.5 million. Over the decades, some strains of the bacteria that cause TB have evolved and can no longer be treated with the most common TB medicines. Roughly 500,000 people become infected with multidrug-resistant TB each year, requiring treatment with betaquiline. The drug reduces the risk of death by approximately 10 percentage points, according to a study in BMC Infectious Diseases. Yet because betaquiline prices are so high, many low- and middle-income governments buy fewer courses of betaquiline and use older, more toxic, less effective drugs to treat TB. Patented profits. Johnson & Johnson initially planned to enforce a secondary patent on a slightly altered version of the drug in more than 30 lower and middle-income countries, including South Africa, Pakistan, and Indonesia. Secondary patents are awarded to pharmaceutical companies for drugs that are similar to ones it's already patented. By careful timing, the second patent, a pharmaceutical company can effectively maintain its exclusive right to manufacture a drug for years after the expiration of its original patent. A new type of deal, an unprecedented deal between Johnson & Johnson and Global Drug Facility, a nonprofit, could dramatically expand access to bedaquiline. The agreement, which was finalized in June and announced July 13, after a social media campaign spearheaded by author John Green, will allow for the sale and manufacture of generic bedaquiline in most lower and middle-income countries. This is the first I'm aware of an innovative company like J&J giving a license to a unique entity like GDF, says Brenda Waning, chief of Global Drug Facility. The brief news, good question, how does COVID-19 affect the brain? By Jamie Ducharme. Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, doctors noticed that for what was originally described as a respiratory virus, SARS-CoV-2 seemed to have a strong effect on the brain, causing everything from loss of taste and smell and brain fog to, in serious cases, stroke. Years later, cognitive decline, changes in brain size and structure, depression, and suicidal thinking, tremors, seizures, memory loss, new or worsened dementia have also been linked to SARS-CoV-2 infections. In some cases, these longer-term problems occur even in patients who had mild COVID-19. The question now is what exactly is going on in the brains of people infected by SARS-CoV-2 and whether the damage can be reversed. Not long after the pandemic began, Dr. Avindra Nath, N-A-T-H, clinical director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, NINDS, and his colleagues analyzed the brains of 13 people who died from COVID-19. They did not find SARS-CoV-2 in those brains, but they did find damage to the blood vessels there, which were coated with antibodies. It looked as if the body's immune system had gone haywire, attacking its own blood vessels, setting off a cascade of effects that led to significant inflammation in the brain, potentially culminating in fatal damage to the part that controls breathing. In people who survive COVID-19, brain inflammation may also explain lasting symptoms like brain fog and memory loss, Noth says. Dr. Laura Jehi, J-E-H-I, who researches COVID-19 and the brain at the Cleveland Clinic, also points to inflammation as a possible trigger. In a 2021 study, Jehi and her colleagues compared the brains of people with long COVID and Alzheimer's disease. We found many areas of overlap between the two, she says, centered on inflammation in the brain and microscopic injuries to the blood vessels. Jehi's team wanted to determine whether SARS-CoV-2 virus was entering the brain and causing damage directly or triggering an immune response that led to brain changes. Their findings pointed to the latter. But researchers still have not ruled out the possibility that the virus has direct effects on the brain. Indeed, since Noth's brain scanning project early in the pandemic, other researchers have found the virus in the brains of people who died from COVID-19. For a 2022 paper, researchers analyzed brain tissue from 11 people who had COVID-19 when they died. In all but one of those people, the researchers found the virus's genetic material in central nervous system tissue, which they wrote proved definitely that SARS-CoV-2 is capable of infecting and replicating within the human brain. To Noth, however, that's still an open question. The research is inconsistent, he says. Some have found it, some have not, and some people who have found it have found very small amounts. There's still a gap in knowledge there. Dr. Wes Ely, or Ely, E-L-Y, who researches brain disease at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, says he is convinced SARS-CoV-2 can attack the support cells of the brain, which ensure neurons can keep the brain and body functioning normally. Damaging these support cells, Ely says, can start a domino effect that leads to brain tissue death. But Ely says almost certainly there are multiple processes going on. It could be that the virus both directly affects the brain and causes changes to the immune system. We are not looking for a magic bullet that will solve all these problems at once, he says. At the moment, altering the immune system to reduce inflammation in the brains of people with long COVID is a promising route. NINDS is enrolling patients for a study on immunotherapy as a potential treatment for neurologic long COVID. That approach is exciting, Noth says, because it entails a therapy that's already used to treat autoimmune and neurologic conditions. So if it proves effective, it could be rolled out to long COVID patients relatively quickly. As of now, there are no proven therapies for people with long COVID symptoms, neurologic or otherwise. But Ely says he's optimistic that COVID-related brain changes are reversible. The brain is incredibly neuroplastic, he says, and it can do amazing things. On to the milestones column. We have several deaths to report, as well as acquitted, shut down, testified, fined, discovered. I'll begin with one of the columns regarding one of the people who have died. Sinead O'Connor, that is spelled S-I-N-E-A-D, O apostrophe C-O-N-N-O-R, protest singer. Small color photo of Sinead O'Connor. Her hair is nearly shaved, but it's, I should say her head. Her hair is nearly shaved from her head, but it's not. One sees the brown tone of her hair almost next to her skin. She has bright blue eyes. She's wearing lip rouge. She's wearing a dark blue and white striped jacket, and that's as far as the shot goes. This photograph conceals herself, I would say. She's looking very solemn, very neutral, just past the camera lens. I am not a pop star, Sinead O'Connor, who died July 26 at 56, wrote in her 2021 memoir. I am just a troubled soul who needs to scream into mics now and then. For many, the Irish musician was much more than that, including both a balm and a battery. Over her 10 studio albums released from 1987 to 2014, she lived as she sang, without compromise, electrified by the injustice and sadness she saw around her, and deploying the excess acid in that battery to empower others. Most people found O'Connor via either the luminous music video for her 1990 cover of Prince's Nothing Compares to You, all bald head, oversized overcoat, wide-eyed ferocity. Or her shredding of a photo of the Pope on live TV 2 years later. Both acts were equally true to her, deeply felt and starkly rendered. Her later years were troubled, but she stayed true to her credo. Whatever it may bring, I will live by my own policies, she sang in that unforgettable voice in 1990. I will sleep with a clear conscience. I will sleep in peace. Belinda Luscombe wrote that slim column. Moving on to the full page here, with another slim column, acquitted actor Kevin Spacey of sexual assault charges by a London jury. July 26, after he testified in his own defense. Shut down. Women only. Beauty salons in Afghanistan by the Taliban, July 25. Testified. A former Air Force intelligence officer at a congressional hearing on UFOs, July 26, that the U.S. is hiding a program that captures and reverse engineers UFOs and found non-human biologics at alleged crash sites. Fined, activist Greta Thunberg, July 24, by a Swedish court for disobeying police during a climate protest at an oil facility. Discovered a new blind and translucent millipede species in Los Angeles, according to a June 21 study. Died Kevin Mitnick, M-I-T-N-I-C-K, a former FBI-wanted hacker turned cybersecurity guru, July 16, at 59. Actor and singer Jane Birkin, B-I-R-K-I-N, namesake of the Hermes Birkin handbag and star of French cinema, July 23, at 76. Finally, an almost two-thirds page column on Died, Tony Bennett, Timeless Pop Music Icon by Andrew R. Chow. About a fourth of this page is a black and white photo of Bennett on stage holding a microphone. Spotlight shining on him, the mic's in his left hand, his right hand is raised as if in a greeting or a thank you to the audience. The spotlight is just plain in his face because he's looking into it with a black background. I see just the outline, the edge of metallic symbols, probably, to his right on stage. Tony Bennett, timeless pop music icon. In the late 1960s, the music mogul Clive Davis told the crooner Tony Bennett to change his style and repertoire. Rock music had taken over the world. Jazz standards didn't cut it anymore, Davis argued. But Bennett stuck to his guns. And over the next six decades, his fierce devotion to a bygone musical era would both revitalize the American songbook and make Bennett, who died July 21 at 96, one of the world's most enduring and beloved music stars. Bennett served in World War II on the Western Front and toiled in small New York club gigs for years before being discovered by the comedian Bob Hope. In the 1950s, he became one of the country's foremost pop idols, singing regularly to audiences of all ages at the Copacabana and Carnegie Hall. His most famous song, 1962's I Left My Heart in San Francisco, went gold, became the official song of the city, was cherished by homesick soldiers in Vietnam who achingly sang along with tinny jukeboxes. Bennett's expressive, enveloping singing voice never wavered. Miraculously, he achieved his greatest commercial success in his last dozen years, some half a century later. As an elder statesman, Bennett turned his focus to duets, introducing the fans of his younger collaborators from Stevie Wonder to Amy Winehouse to classic American songwriting. In 2011, at 85 years old, he scored his first number one hit on the Billboard 200 with Duets 2, making him the oldest artist ever to top the charts. When Lady Gaga was struggling with fame and physical pain, Bennett took the young star under his wing. The unlikely pair proceeded to form a deep musical bond, record the number one album, Cheek to Cheek, and tour across the world to the tune of $15.3 million. "I tell Tony every day that he saved my life," Lady Gaga said in 2014. For many, Bennett was synonymous with class, craftsmanship, perseverance, and American excellence, a great of the greatest generation. He marched at Selma and donated time and money to civil rights, arts education, and cancer research. After being diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2016, he continued to deliver knockout performances of songs he learned 60 years prior. Bennett died a Kennedy Center honoree, an NEA jazz master, a 19-time Grammy winner. He sang for every president from Eisenhower to Obama. "For my money," Frank Sinatra said several times, "Tony Bennett is the best singer in the business." The Brief Health by Angela Haupt. 5 Healthy Ways to Deal with Anger. One of the easiest things about experiencing anger is finding a colorful word or phrase to describe it. Steaming. Fuming and fired up and furious. Pissed off. Ready to flip your lid. Livid. Such an extensive lexicon speaks to the universality of anger, one of the most primitive emotions humans experience, and in some ways one of the most complex. People do not like to feel angry, and most people who do feel angry want to get rid of the anger, says Brad Bushman, a professor of communication at The Ohio State University, who studies human aggression and violence. But it also makes people feel powerful. That can be channeled into a positive force. Consider that anger has fueled many social and political movements, from women's suffrage to Black Lives Matter. The feeling can signal that something we're experiencing or observing is misaligned with our values or how we want others to treat us or our fellow humans. Unfortunately, experts say, most of us do not know how to deal with anger in a healthy way. It is the negative emotion that people have the most difficulty regulating, Bushman notes. This is not something that comes easy. That is why courts send people to anger management classes. If it were easy, they wouldn't have to do that. Anger drives numerous societal problems, Bushman says. It is one of the largest risk factors for aggressive and violent behavior, including road rage incidents, domestic violence, and murders. Plus, it can lead to short and long-term health effects, including heightened inflammation and risk of chronic illness, reduced lung function, chronic pain, digestive problems, increased depression and anxiety. Research suggests that in the 2 hours after feeling angry, a person's risk of a heart attack jumps nearly fivefold. We asked Bushman and other experts to share the healthiest ways to cope with and express anger. 1. Focus on relaxing instead of venting. When we are angry, Bushman explains, we're highly aroused. Venting or otherwise blowing off steam, even by going for a run, keeps arousal high and is like using gasoline to put out a fire. It feeds the flame. Instead, you should reduce that arousal level. Bushman suggests turning down the heat by practicing deep breathing, meditating, or doing yoga or progressive muscle relaxation. Take a time out. Tony Fior has been teaching anger management with a focus on repairing relationships for decades. One of the first tips he imparts to his clients, it's okay to get away from each other. If you prevent somebody from leaving, they can become like a wild animal, says Fior, a psychologist who is the author of books including Anger Management for the 21st Century. Sometimes getting away for 10 minutes or an hour or a couple hours drastically changes things when you come back. Use the break to figure out how you would like to calmly respond instead of immediately reacting while riled up. Try the 30-30-30 intervention. First, take 30 seconds to extract yourself from the situation, perhaps by leaving the room or stepping outside, says Laura Beth Moss, a supervisor with the National Anger Management Association. Then distract yourself for 30 seconds by doing something else, even planning what you'll have for dinner. After that, use the final 30 seconds to create a coping statement that will help de-escalate your emotions. Say you're fuming about how much of a jerk your boss is. A reframe would be something like, I don't prefer it when my boss talks to me in a condescending tone, but deep down I know I am not a product of that relationship, Moss says. Keep an anger log. Anger, A-N-G-E-R, log. It is a simple but effective way for those interested in better controlling their emotions to analyze how, when, and why they get ticked off. Typically, Moss instructs clients to track one anger situation a week, which means writing down what happened and when, how it made them feel, and how they responded. That presents an opportunity to strategize ways to think about and respond to triggering situations. And finally, the fifth, use assertive communication. The goal is to be respectful of yourself and the person you're talking to, says Julia Baum, a licensed therapist who practices in New York and California. Aim to share your feelings. Explain to the other person why you feel that way. Let them know what you hope to get out of talking about it together. Make a point of checking in with the person you're talking to about how they are feeling. Ask them if there's anything they're feeling upset with you about, Baum suggests. They might have been rude because they were angry about some earlier encounter that you did not clock. Here is the six questions page. This is by Judy Berman. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, I see more. It says six questions, folks, but I'm reading 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, well, somebody didn't count right. There's a photograph here in black and white. It's not real large. It's of a woman with long dark hair, dark eyes, huge pearl earrings dangling from her ears, a very large smile, and she's wearing probably a white or very pale colored jacket. Fran Drescher, D-R-E-S-C-H-E-R, the president of the Actors Union on joining the writer's strike, the impact of streaming and AI, and the nanny memes burning up the net. This is in the question and answer format, again led by Judy Berman, with Fran Drescher, the subject. Question, it's hard for some people to reconcile reports of A-list stars commanding tens of millions in salaries with the news of an actor strike. Why has a union representing such an apparently lucrative profession taken such a dramatic step? Answer, those big stars, they draw people into the theaters and allow everybody below them to make a living. but most people in this 160,000 member strong union make not enough to even be eligible for health benefits. Most actors just want to pay rent, put food on the table, and be respected. Those are the people we must strike for. When the opposition says that if you're a background person, we'll scan your image with AI and pay you for one day, then own your likeness in perpetuity, where does that leave that performer? This is from a statement released July 7. The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers said its proposal requires a performer's consent for the creation and use of digital replicas. Question, how has the streaming economy affected actors' livelihoods? Answer, well, let's look at The Nanny. That business model was predicated on the longevity of a show that went from network TV into syndication. There was a long tail of revenue upon which residuals were based. As long as there were ad dollars, you would do between 22 and 28 episodes a season, between 6 and 10 seasons. With streaming, there's no tail of revenue, no transparency as to how well the show does. The name of the game is subscribers. That reduces the episodes per season to between 6 and 10, and the seasons to 3 or 4. You can't live on that. Question. You call Disney CEO Bob Iger's characterization of SAG-AFTRA, that's SAG-AFTRA, and the WGA's demands as unrealistic, repugnant, and out of touch. What do you make of an executive who stands to make $31 million this year, shrugging off the plight of journeyman actors? Answer, I have nothing against capitalism, but when you become intoxicated by the money to the point where you stop feeling compassion for people, it becomes like a sickness. The CEOs on private jets and billionaires' camp and yachts, they're doing bad things to good people. Question, since your speech launching the strike, July 13, people on social media have been sharing a still from an episode of The Nanny where your character says, never, ever, ever cross a picket line. What has it been like to see this moment rediscovered? Answer, I'm proud. I came up with that strike episode of The Nanny. I am enjoying the creativity of the people in support of this righteous strike. We stand on the front lines of a whole labor movement that stands behind us, but everybody stands to benefit from our success because everybody's in jeopardy of being replaced by AI or being undercut or underpaid. Question, have labor issues been at the forefront of your mind throughout your career? Answer, without question, because I come from a humble beginning. We all get sick, laugh, cry, want the same things for our children. When people in powerful positions behave poorly, when I look at those people across the negotiating table, I am thinking, how could you do this? Your whole job is to screw us. Question, I guess that's why we need unions in the first place. Answer, really? I mean, Frederick Douglass said power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. And who knew better than him? And finally, what I'm now counting as the seventh question, do you think AI is purely a job killer, or might there be a fair way for studios to use it? Answer, consent and compensation must be in the DNA of this new invention. Our livelihood is our likeness, the way we act, speak, the gestures we make. That is what we are selling, and that is what they want to rip off. Well, we are not going to do that. The next article is lengthy and may be abridged. Under the heading Climate, the boiling point. Extreme heat is endangering America's workers and its economy. By Aaron, A-R-Y-N, Baker, Georgia. Climate. 7 a.m., Copeland Farms, Rochelle, Georgia. Just after dawn on a recent July day in Rochelle, Georgia, Sylvia Moreno Ayala steps into a pair of sturdy work pants, slips on a long-sleeve shirt, slathers her face and hands with sunscreen. She drapes a flowered scarf over her wide-brimmed hat to protect her neck and back from the punishing rays of the sun. There isn't much she can do about the humidity, however. Morning is supposed to be the coolest part of the day, but sweat is already pooling in her rubber boots. She drinks deeply from a plastic water bottle, then squeezes out the air until it's flattened enough to tuck into her back pocket so she can keep her hands free while working the fields. On some days, it might be hours before she makes it back to the drinks-filled cooler that Moreno, a 41-year-old farm worker who came to the U.S. from Mexico as a teen, has left at the field's edge. And she's heard the horror stories of farm workers dying because they didn't stay hydrated. Moreno accepts headaches, nausea, muscle cramps, dizzy spells, signs of severe heat stress, as an inevitable part of her summer workday. But by sipping a little tepid water as she goes, she hopes to stave off a worse outcome. I know people who work watermelons and get so hot they end up in the hospital, she says. Her doctor warns that she might too one day. He says her kidneys, already damaged by years of working in hot conditions, won't be able to take much more. Dozens of workers have likely already died from heat exposure this year, shaping up to be the hottest in U.S. history. The death toll started New Year's Day in Florida when a 28-year-old laborer working on a bell pepper farm died from heat stroke. June 16, with temperatures hovering around 100 Fahrenheit, construction worker Felipe Pascual overheated and died at his work site near Houston. June 19, a 35-year-old power lineman in East Texas succumbed to heat exposure on a 96-degree Fahrenheit day. A day later, 66-year-old postal worker Eugene Gates Jr. died, making his rounds in Dallas. While a cause of death has yet to be determined, temperatures that day reached 115 degrees Fahrenheit. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 400 workers die every year. 40 workers die every year from heat, most in outdoor jobs like farming, construction, package delivery. But the official statistics do not tell the real story, says Doug Parker, director of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. We are confident that's an undercount, probably a significant undercount, largely because the role of heat is often overlooked on death certificates for cardiac arrest and respiratory failure. Public Citizen, a D.C.-based advocacy group, estimates extreme heat contributes to between 600 and 2,000 deaths a year, along with 170,000 injuries. Climate change is supercharging the problem. At least a third of the U.S. population was under an extreme heat advisory at some point this summer, and next summer is likely to be worse as the warming El Niño weather cycle intensifies during the winter. While the past 8 years have been the hottest in history, they're also likely to be the coolest of the next century. On a planet 4.86 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, our current end-of-century trajectory, 33 times as many people would be subjected to dangerously high levels of extreme or humid heat. But no matter how hot it gets, garbage still must be collected, packages delivered, houses roofed, roads constructed, produce plucked for grocery store shelves. A 2020 study found the average U.S. farm worker already endures dangerous levels of heat for 21 days of the year. By 2050, that number could jump to 39, and by the end of the century, to 62. In most states, you can be fined for leaving a dog outside without water or shade. But outside of California, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, agricultural workers do not have the same protections, nor do roofers, road construction crews, delivery drivers, garbage collectors, or almost any other outdoor workers. With the risk to some 50 million Americans comes an estimated $100 billion in lost productivity, increased workers' comp premiums, lawsuits, health care costs. Protecting outdoor workers from extreme heat is easy and in most cases inexpensive. Public Citizen estimates that requiring employers to provide workers with cool water and periodic shaded rest breaks could prevent at least 50,000 injuries and illnesses a year. In 2021, President Joe Biden asked OSHA to draft a federal protocol that would do just that, but OSHA rulemaking is slow, and meanwhile, opposition's ramping up, led by industry groups that hold that heat protections are too onerous a burden for business. 9 a.m., UPS sorting facility, Rome, Georgia. By 9 a.m., some 90,000 UPS drivers across the country roll out of distribution centers in their iconic brown trucks, ready to transport the clothes, books, frozen fish, furniture, toilet paper, medicines, and overnight mail Americans depend upon. The trucks, primed for efficiency and easy maintenance, are neither air-conditioned nor insulated. Working all day in heat like this is physically painful, says driver Barkley Wimpy, as he pulls his truck out of the lot on a recent 92-degree Fahrenheit morning. Unlike farm workers, drivers cannot take advantage of the pre-dawn cool. Deliveries must be made during working hours. By the time we get going, the sun's already blazing, says Wimpy, 28. I'm sweating before I leave the parking lot. Larry McBride, a 46-year-old UPS driver based in Phoenix, keeps a thermometer in the back of his van. Some days the temperature exceeds 135 degrees Fahrenheit. Drivers spend most of their time in those sweltering holds, shifting and selecting the packages they need for delivery. Before you realize it, you start getting disoriented, lightheaded, like you might pass out, he says. When you step outside, even if it's 115 degrees out, you will feel like you got blasted with AC because it is so hot back there. Last summer, McBride and Wimpy both succumbed to heat exhaustion while making their rounds, and both ended up in the hospital with acute kidney injury. According to company records submitted to OSHA, at least a dozen UPS workers are hospitalized for heat-related injuries every year. Not all survive. June 25, 2022, Esteban Chavez, 24, died of suspected heat stroke while delivering packages on a 95-degree day in Pasadena, California, a tragedy that renewed calls for air conditioning the fleet. Doing so, says company spokespeople at the time, was impractical, given that drivers were constantly jumping in and out of the vehicles to make their deliveries. June 16, 2023, UPS's 340,000 Teamsters Union members voted to strike starting August 1. In the final stages of contract negotiations, the company had agreed to air condition all new vehicles starting in 2024. McBride says the bigger issue is the relentless pace. Drivers are expected to deliver between 150 and 300 packages a day, and their progress is monitored by dashboard-mounted cameras. We need more breaks, he says. Drivers are doing 10, 12-hour days in extreme heat. That's too much for a body to take. It accumulates over time, and you cannot recover. That's when things go wrong. Skipping now to the last paragraph, 9 a.m., Phoenix, Tulsa, Baton Rouge, Jackson, Laredo, Key West, Las Vegas, Bakersfield, Memphis, Macon, dozens of other U.S. cities by 9 a.m. the next day. Temperatures from California to Florida are approaching 100 degrees Fahrenheit, sparking extreme heat advisories for nearly a third of the American population. Public health officials are urging residents to drink water, stay indoors, avoid outside exercise. But farmhands in Florida, road construction crews in Texas, delivery drivers in Phoenix are hard at work, keeping America running under life-threatening conditions. Legally, they have no choice. Why are we being asked to choose between working and staying alive? Asks UPS driver Larry McBride as he texts a photo of the temperature reading from the back of his truck. It shows 137.3 degrees Fahrenheit. This is just going to continue where we are dropping like flies. That lengthy article was considerably abridged, written by Aaron Baker, Georgia, with co-reporting with Georgia Public Broadcasting Sophie Gratis and Grant Blankenship, Rochelle Rome, and Macon, with additional reporting from Moisa Sala, Macon, Diane Tsai, Salt Lake City, Leslie Dickstein, and Julia Zorthian, New York. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.